Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today on this 4th of July, we will look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Ron Kovic, whose birthday it is today. He served two tours of duty during the Vietnam War and was paralyzed from the chest down in combat in 1968 and has been in a wheelchair ever since. Along with Oliver Stone, Kovic was the co-screenwriter of the 1989 Academy Award-winning memoir Born on the 4th of July, which starred Tom Cruise as Kovic. He joins us to discuss the reissue of a new edition of his book Born on the 4th of July with a foreword by Bruce Springsteen and his latest book just out today, Hurricane Street, which chronicles the activism that Ron Kovic and other wounded veterans had to resort to by staging sit-ins and hunger strikes to get the health care and treatment that he and other disabled Vietnam vets were promised and deserved. By occupying a U.S. senator's office, the Washington Monument, and bathrooms in the White House, Kovic and his comrades changed how Veterans Affairs hospitals cared for our wounded vets. Then on this Independence Day, we'll examine the need for a declaration of economic independence and the implementation of a new economic Bill of Rights, which President Franklin Roosevelt declared in his last address to the nation. William K. Black, distinguished scholar in residence at the University of Minnesota and a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, joins us to discuss the extent to which populist anger today in both the UK with the Brexit vote and in the US with the Sanders campaign on the left and the Trump campaign on the right are a result of the failure of Tony Blair's new Labour policies in the UK and Bill Clinton's new Democratic programs in the US, which have left working class voters treading water at the bottom while the rewards from increased productivity and trade deals go to the top. And joining us now on this 4th of July weekend is Ron Kovic, who served two tours of duty during the Vietnam War. He was paralyzed from his chest down in combat in 1968 and has been in a wheelchair ever since. Along with Oliver Stone, Kovic was the co-screenwriter of the 1989 Academy Award-winning film based on Kovic's best-selling memoir Born on the 4th of July, starring Tom Cruise as Kovic. His new book, just out today, is Hurricane Street. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ron Kovic.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure and a joy to be with you.
Well, thank you, Ron. And of course, as well as Hurricane Street being released over this 4th of July holidays, you've got a reissue of Born on the 4th of July.
Yeah, believe it or not, it's been 40 years since Born on the 4th of July was published in 1976, and 40 years have passed. We have a special 40th anniversary edition coming out on that's actually my, you know, the 4th of July. And today being my 70th birthday, which is really ironic because when I wrote Born on the 4th of July, I began in my late 20s, and it came out on the 4th of July, 1976, the 200th anniversary of the country, the bicentennial, and now 40 years have passed, and Hurricane Street and the special edition 40th anniversary edition of Born on the 12th of July would be coming out on this very day, the 240th anniversary of our country. And by the way, if I could also add that we were fortunate enough to have Bruce Springsteen write the foreword to the 40th anniversary edition.
I was about to say that. That's quite a coup, and it's a beautiful introduction that Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, he did a great job, and he was also kind enough, by the way, to do the. They're doing an audio of both Hurricane Street and 4th of July, and those will be coming out today as well on the same day. Yeah.
Well,
he did the audio of his foreword, so he was. He really went out of his way to do that. I really appreciate that.
Well, when you mention Ron Kovic, the founding fathers are, you know, obliquely in the sense that this is it, celebrating our independence, of course, and the first American president in his farewell address, President George Washington, warned about the impostors of pretended patriotism. And this is something that is really burns me, is that for all of the sacrifice that you and countless other American young men and women have made in the wars since World War II and since the Vietnam War, there is also this huge sort of industry of the wounded warriors, and nothing is too good. Our politicians keep saying there's nothing too good for our boys and girls. And as Hurricane Street points out, You've had to fight tooth and nail.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it began, actually, I was wounded on paralyzed from my mid-chest down 48 years ago, almost half a century. I've been in a wheelchair now because of that war. And I'm grateful for every day that I wake up, every day I can get into my wheelchair. I'm so thankful to be alive. Having said that, I was wounded. I was 21 years old, and it was devastating for me both initially, both emotionally and physically. The first VA hospital I was in was the Bronx Veterans Administration Hospital in New York. I had grown up on Long Island. And the Bronx VA, the conditions were atrocious, overcrowded conditions, rats on the ward, men pushing call buttons for aides who would never come. Eventually, Life magazine did a May 1970 an expose on the Bronx VA, in particular our spinal cord injury wards. The title of the piece was Our Forgotten Wounded. So I was dealing with that from the very beginning. And when I came out to California, as I mentioned in Hurricane Street, you know, I thought thousands of miles away, I'm coming out to California. It's got to be different than it was in the Bronx, what I went through and what I had to endure and the others around me. Some of the most severely wounded of the war, we were just wanted to be treated like human beings. And I just couldn't understand at first, when I first came home from the war, why the place was so depressing, why people were not helping us. And, you know, they were spending millions, if not trillions of dollars on some of the most technologically advanced weaponry of that war, and they couldn't seem to care for some of the most severely injured who had come home. So when I came out to California, I thought, well, it's got to be different. But what I found at the Long Beach VA was the conditions were as bad, if not worse, than the Bronx VA. And I found myself, I fell and I had a bed sore, which is always a challenge for paraplegics, and I ended up in the hospital. I was on a gurney for 93 days, and it was during that period that I realized that there were others like me and others who were complaining about the conditions. And what happened was we decided, reluctantly at first, decided to do to go to Senator Krantz's office at 11,000 Wilshire Boulevard, the federal building, and we made a caravan up there, and we decided, I encouraged the men, I told them we were going to do a sit-in for one day, actually we were going to meet with the senator, then go out to lunch. We ended up sitting in for one night, and that eventually evolved into a hunger strike, which was to become a national story. The irony of that, if I could just say quickly, the absurdity of it all was that here you had some of the most severely wounded of the war who had returned from Vietnam, these young men, 19 and 20, 21-year-old paralyzed veterans, quadriplegics and paraplegics, laying on mattresses on a United States senator's office, risking their lives again, sacrificing themselves, going without food for 17 days. That's how long that strike lasted. And these men who had risked their lives in Vietnam were now risking their lives again in a senator's office here where they should have been cared for properly. To me, as I look back upon it, it still seems a bit absurd that we had to go to such extremes to be treated with respect. And I always felt this was a story I had to tell because I always felt it was an important story that these men who felt beaten down and defeated, who felt a part of this outrageous, what would the word be, outrageous, misdirected, misadventure in Vietnam, would actually take this step, do this sit-in, reluctantly get involved, and suddenly realize, be empowered by this, and changed by this experience, and to eventually have a victory in the midst of a time when the country was so polarized and split, and when those who had been wounded in the war wondered, what had I sacrificed my body for?
And again, I'm speaking with Ron Kovic, who served two tours of duty during the Vietnam War. He was paralyzed from his chest down in combat in 1968 and has been in a wheelchair ever since. And along with Oliver Stone, Kovic was the co-screenwriter of the 1989 Academy Award-winning film based on Kovic's best-selling memoir, Born on the 4th of July, starring Tom Cruise as Kovic. His new book just out is Hurricane Street. Now, Senator Cranston, of course, was actually one of the good guys, and what you
very supportive, yes, very progressive, very supportive, yeah. And you know, I didn't know that much about him during that period, and I actually grew to respect his positions and the work he did. But the most important thing to remember is on February 12th, which was Lincoln's birthday. Ironically, that was the day we caravaned or convoyed to Westwood. And in our vans, in our hand-controlled cars, and we got out in the parking lot in back of the federal building, you know, wheelchairs, and we went up there. One of the things that Senator Cranston did was he was sympathetic. He had a very important position in Washington on the Veterans Hospital Committee during that period, and he was up for re-election, and I knew that. I was calculating that as I put this together, and I had several of the veterans say to me, well, what's going to stop them from arresting us? And I said, you know, it just wouldn't look good on television with a senator up for re-election to drag a bunch of paralyzed veterans out of his office. I don't think it's going to happen, and I think we're going to hold the office. So I was just hoping, we were hoping that we might be able to stay in the office and not get arrested. So what happened was Senator Cranston actually was very sympathetic. The very first night, he sent mattresses and food from the Westwood VA Food Services Department, sent it over to us, and that was at least for the first night. After that, the food stopped, and that's when we made the commitment to go on a hunger strike, which was, you know, we escalated our tactics. Our bodies would now become our weapons, and you know, we were really desperate. The second day, most of the guys who came down with me in their wheelchairs, the first day, they left. They had enough of it. You know, they were not in for for the long haul, for a long strike. But I knew we had to stay there and stay there for as long as we could. I knew we needed to get media attention. And I knew we could hopefully somehow turn that office into a sort of create a theater of a VA hospital ward so that the American public and at first the people of Los Angeles would begin to realize that something was happening down at the VA, not just the Long Beach VA, but in veterans hospitals all over the country. And the only way we were going to do that was to do something dramatic. And there were only two of us left, and after that first day, that the next day, we spent the night, all of us, and then everyone left except two of us, myself and the character Bobby Mays, who both of us made a commitment to go on a hunger strike. We called the Associated Press that night, and we were getting calls left and right the following morning. And by that late that afternoon, almost all of the guys who had initially come down with us to do the sit-in, they returned because it was on television by then and on the radio, and they decided to come back, and they made a commitment to go on the hunger strike, if but reluctantly. But what was amazing was some of these guys had never done an interview before. They'd never been in front of a camera, and this was all new to them. They were very hesitant at first, but it was really exciting for me to watch them mature, to watch them realize that they had a power they didn't even realize. And that these men who felt abandoned down in that hospital were now watching themselves on television, listening to themselves on the radio, and reading about themselves in the L.A. Times just about every day. And it changed them. They really got into the strike, and their commitment was as deep as anything you could imagine.
So, Ron Kovic, in effect, did you sort of start the Occupy movement before the Occupy movement started?
I don't think so, no. It was just, you know, it was instinctive. I was very involved. Up until then, I had been arrested already several times. I had protested the war. I had been a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I had already been to Miami Beach to protest the Republican National Convention. I'd been thrown out of the convention hall by security guards with two other disabled veterans in August of 1972 after shouting down President Nixon during his acceptance speech. So I had already been involved, but once I became a patient in the VA because of the bed sore, and I spent several months there and realized we had problems, I decided to organize. We were organizing right in the hospital prior to the hunger strike in Senator Cranston's office. We first began gatherings in back of the paraplegic ward, just a few of us talking. But then we decided to actually create a group called the Patient Workers Rights Committee, which we did, and we began to bring others in from not only the paraplegic wards, but veterans from all around the hospital. At first, we had only a few having our Thursday night meetings in back of the paraplegic ward, and then we had up to, I think at the peak, there was up to 150. And the powers that be at the hospital got really nervous. They were, ironically, they were sending around security photographing us with their high-powered lenses at our meetings. That was the atmosphere back then, though. There was a lot of concern. They didn't know what was going on. And another thing we were doing during that period, we were hiding. I hid a tape recorder under my pillow. I was forced to lay on a gurney for 93 days. I wasn't able to sit up just to heal the sore that I had. And I moved around the wards with two canes on my stomach. It was really something. And I started taping and different patients, taping their complaints and putting this all together. We eventually had a press conference, which is a chapter in Hurricane Street. Jane Fonda, I found out, was speaking at Long Beach State. She was going to speak at Long Beach State on the same day that we planned to have the press conference in back of the paraplegic ward. I contacted her through one of her assistants. I had shared the stage with her at several anti-war demonstrations prior to that, prior to me ending up in the hospital, and she agreed to join our press conference, and that really brought out a lot of press, and that was quite an event, and that's a whole chapter in Hurricane Street. Yeah.
Well, also, though, you took the protest to Washington, D.C. itself. You occupied the White House bathroom.
Oh, yeah, after the hunger strike. You know, it's really, it was just really human. The fact is, all throughout this short-lived movement, there was always it always seemed like everything was going to break apart. Which that's the way life is, and people just, I've had enough. From the very beginning, people didn't even want to participate after one night or one sit-in. They weren't ready for that type of commitment. But each time, several times, everything felt as if it was going to fall apart during the strike. And then after the strike ended and we went back to Hurricane Street, Marina Del Rey, it's a little beach house not far from the ocean, not far from the Washington Street Pier in Venice. It's really, just as we finished the strike, we won the strike, I can say that much. We forced the head of the VA to come out and meet with us, and changes were eventually made. But we went back to Hurricane Street initially so enthused that we said, we'll never leave each other. We're going to stay together forever. That lasted about a week, and then some of the guys started saying, I've got to go back to the hospital. I want to, it didn't last that long. So I decided to encourage them to do a second American bonus march. And we became involved. You remember the bonus march in Washington during the Great Depression, right, during the Roosevelt? Prior to Roosevelt, Hoover, right?
Right, it was after World War One. The vets from World War One weren't given the payments that they were promised.
And I believe there were Hoovervilles sprouting up all over the country. And
veterans. And General MacArthur, by the way,
that's right.
He broke it up viciously, using the U.S. Army to beat up veterans.
That's right. They burned down the shanty town that the veterans had constructed. I believe it was on Anacostia Flats, and that was something they never forgot. But we decided to have a second one, and we got into it. And our march pretty much fell apart. It was not what we expected. It was a disaster. And in an attempt to reclaim our dignity, we decided one night, while camped out in Lafayette Park, just across from the White House, only of a few of us left, tired, hungry, and having not showered in days, we decided to take over the top of the Washington Monument in hopes that we could garner some media support. And we were going to take over the monument and also send several veterans in their wheelchairs onto the White House tourist line and take over a room or a building in the White House. And we ended up taking over the top of the monument, and the veterans who went into the White House, they couldn't find a room to take over, so they ended up taking over one of the bathrooms of the White House, and they eventually were released, and we were arrested. We spent the night in jail, a Washington jail, and then we were released the next day. But as you'll read in the epilogue at the end of the book, the movement eventually splintered and it disintegrated. But for one brief moment, as I write at the end of the book, that spring, long ago, we came together. Miraculously, we somehow came together, these wounded men, and they resisted, they raised their voice, they empowered themselves, and they fought back, and they realized that even though they had nothing, there was still a power within them, and we were able to win a victory just as the war was ending.
Ron, it happened while the Nixon impeachment was going on.
How ironic, Ian, so true. I mean, it was such an interesting time. All throughout the strike, it was on the news all the time, the impeachment hearings, and I believe, wasn't it in around August when Nixon was finally forced to resign? About that time?
And, what a bookend. Here you were in 1972 at the Republican Convention protesting Richard Nixon's acceptance speech for a second term.
Yeah.
And you bookend at that with protesting and seizing the White House bathrooms at the time that he was being impeached.
Protesting in 72, they were dragging me out of the hall. And one gentleman, a Republican, with all respect, I forgive him after all these years, came up to me, called me a traitor, and spit in my face as they were dragging me out with the other disabled veterans. But, many years have passed, and it was an extraordinary time, a tumultuous time. I don't think I would have wanted to live any other time than I've lived through so far. And, despite my paralysis, I can say to you, and I can say to everybody else on this 4th of July, that I'm so grateful for my life. I'm grateful for every day. I'm so thankful to be here, and I just want to continue to contribute, to write, and I know I've got some more stories in me as well.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back continuing the conversation with Ron Kovic on this 4th of July.
The dawn's early light, by all I know is right, we're gonna reap what we have sown. This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them and my heroes. I've always died at so who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and we continue the conversation with Ron Kovic on this 4th of July. So let's turn, though, again, Ron Kovic, your book, Born on the 4th of July, was made into a very, very famous movie, and your new book, Hurricane Street, both coming out. The new version of Born on the 4th of July is a foreword by Bruce Springsteen. And we're talking, of course, about Hurricane Street, successful protests since. But the fact that you've had to protest in itself is a bit of a scandal. And I was mentioning the farewell address of the country's first president, George Washington, warning about the impostors of pretended patriotism. And I find it extraordinary to think that respect for veterans has become a kind of fundraising tool. You see the Wounded Warrior Project, where they had a big scandal.
Yes.
And it was on TV all the time, advertising and basically making money for the people that ran the charity, not for the vets themselves. You've got these insurance companies that say how much they care about vets, et cetera, et cetera. The politicians say how much they care about vets. Everybody's ready to use the love that Americans have for their veterans as a marketing tool, but they don't seem to be spending too much time actually helping vets. How do you explain that?
It's such a great point that you're making. You know, I remember watching those the Wounded Warrior commercials on television and watching the wounded, and I remember all I could think of was how hard I tried to speak out, to do interviews prior to that deployment in both in Afghanistan and in Iraq. I sensed what was going on. I saw the same pattern repeating itself all over again, as I'm sure many others who had lived through that period realized, here we go again. And I did everything I could to try to stop it. You know, one of the things other than political was I knew the human cost of war. I was still living with it every day when those two policies began to move forward. And it hurt me as I watched more and more of my fellow citizens get behind the war, and I watched the newspapers begin to become, begin rallying for the war and waving their flags so jingoistically, and everybody getting involved in, let's go to war, let's get involved. And nobody really was thinking about the consequences of what was going to happen. I saw them ahead of time. That's the one gift, I guess, I and others have who have been through these wars, and especially these wars that mean that make no sense and are absolutely unnecessary and unconscionable. I would watch these ads, and rather than being inspired that we've got to help our veterans, I would think to myself, well, of course we do, but why did you allow this to happen? Look what you've done. Look what you've done. Another generation maimed. Another generation wounded physically, psychologically, PTSD, traumatic brain injury. Is there no conscience in this country? Is there no morality? Are you not awake? Are you not conscious of what this all adds up to? I'm in this wheelchair for the rest of my life. Most of my friends have died. Many of those involved in the Hurricane Street resistance and hunger strike in the spring of 74 have long since passed away, a few of them to suicide. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm still here. I'm still here, stubbornly here, because I feel like my voice is still important. I believe I can still make a difference. And yet I'm watching this unfold, and I'm wondering, you know, yet inside I have a faith in the American people. I believe that we do learn from our mistakes. It may not become apparent right away, but I do believe, you know, I remember Franklin Roosevelt saying at the end of the just awful cataclysm of World War II that he still had faith that we as human beings were moving in an upward curve, you know, that we were still, despite the great cataclysm of this war and the wars prior to, that we as a species, as human beings, were moving towards something better. And I have to believe that. I've always had a bit of a positive side to my, to who I am. And I don't think it's what would the word be, Pollyanna? I think it's real. I really do believe that people learn from Vietnam, and people are a little bit more skeptical of their government. And they, I encourage people to challenge their government, to not always go along with things as they are, because things as they are sometimes lead to disastrous endings. You know.
Well, indeed, in the Iraq War and Afghan wars that you protested at the time, look what disasters they've turned into. And you can trace the current problems in the Middle East and in Europe, by the way, because all those refugees are coming from Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. And, of course, that fueled the recent Brexit vote. So, in other words, we still haven't. The collateral damage from those wars continues to this day.
And another thing, if I could add, to the earlier question, I don't know if I answered it properly, but in regard to our veterans and the way they're treated, the superficiality of thank you for your service, you're all heroes, and the fact is, if many of them didn't go, they'd end up in the brig, and the fact is that once you sign that contract, and once, for instance, I joined the Marine Corps, and once you go into the service, you really have no other choice. It's not a particular democracy inside the military. When you're told to go somewhere, you go, and if you don't go, you go to jail. I mean, it's important that people realize that there's not always such a willingness to go. Though, you know, I must say, I was very patriotic. I had been inspired by John F. Kennedy, his Ask What I Can Do for My Country speech. And, I volunteered for my first tour. I volunteered to join the Marines. That's what probably makes it so ironic. I volunteered for both tours of duty in Vietnam, only to be, to sacrifice my body in that war. But, I don't know what to say.
Well, Ron, my best wishes to you, and I'm sure the listeners join me in this on this 4th of July, and keep up the great work.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's a pleasure to do this interview, and it's a special birthday present for me to be with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Ron. And again, I've been speaking with Ron Kovic, who served two tours of duty during the Vietnam War. He was paralyzed from his chest down in combat in 1968 and has been in a wheelchair ever since. Along with Oliver Stone, Ron was the co-screenwriter of the 1989 Academy Award-winning film based on Kovic's best-selling memoir, Born on the 4th of July, starring Tom Cruise as Kovic. His new book, just out today, along with a reissue of Born on the 4th of July, is Hurricane Street. And Ron Kovic will be at the Manhattan Beach Library this Wednesday, July the 6th at 7 p.m., reading and signing at the Manhattan Beach Public Radio, Born on the 4th of July, and the new book, Hurricane Street. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back on this Independence Day with an examination of the need for a declaration of economic independence and the implementation of a new economic bill of rights. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now on this 4th of July is William K. Black, who's a distinguished scholar in residence for financial regulation at the University of Minnesota, as well as a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He's the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s, and is a white-collar criminologist and the founding member of Bank Whistleblowers United, and the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He has an article at Truthdig, The Terrible Cost to Democrats and American Society of Ignoring Thomas Frank's Warnings. Welcome to Background Briefing, William K. Black.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
And, of course, on Independence Day, we celebrate patriotism and the Founding Fathers and the American Revolution. But in many ways, given the restiveness on the left with Bernie Sanders and on the right with Donald Trump, it seems like there's a kind of rebellion brewing in the country that might well be calling for an economic revolution to basically rescue America from penury, from the predation of the 1%, and to restore some social justice. They're certainly not going to get it with Donald Trump, and Bernie Sanders is not the nominee, so it's not going to happen with him. But do you accept the premise, Bill Black, that the country is sort of calling out for an economic revolution?
It is, for some really fundamental change, because there's been a fundamental change over the last 35 years, and it's a direct rejection of what the American system had come to stand for. I mean, obviously, back in the creation of the U.S. Constitution was in the historical backdrop, actually, of an anti-populist movement. Of course, there were rebellions breaking out, Shays Rebellion and such, and it was very much a protect the rich people with capital and land, which meant land in those days. But eventually, America got reconstructed in terms of the New Deal and the whole concept of the freedoms, and there was a period of very substantial economic growth and generally reducing inequality, dramatically increased lifespan and such. But much of this reversed about 35 years ago, such that the working class net-net has been a loser in terms of real income. It's actually fallen in many of these years and time periods. Even life expectancy is now falling for an important chunk of Americans. And they've been losing because, in the phrase of Senator Warren, which again goes back to much of FDR's critique, because the system is rigged against these folks. So it's been amazing. There's been a whole series of articles in the context of Brexit, Britain exiting the European Union or the EU, of how strange this is. And, you know, so first, in the, somewhere in the long article, they'll mention, well, of course, the working class has been hammered for 35 years. But isn't it astonishing that they're actually doing something about it? How dare they? Even through democratic processes and such. So you're right. The question is, who is actually going to provide that? Many people thought that Senator Sanders was a good source of that. In full disclosure, I'm an economic advisor to Senator Sanders. He's, you know, clearly not going to be the nominee absent something pretty extraordinary, the Democratic Party. And Donald Trump has an entire lifetime of ripping off the working class. But he's found a voice, of course, as a supposed supporter of the working class, in particular a couple of days ago with his speech on trade.
So in terms of for the benefit of the audience, we should mention, I mentioned the article that you've just written at Truthdig, The Terrible Cost to Democrats and American Society of Ignoring Thomas Frank's Warning. Just briefly encapsulate what Thomas Frank's warnings, plural, have been.
Sure. And this article was originally on our UMKC Economics blog, New Economic Perspectives. Truthdig and Naked Capitalism and others have been nice enough to repost. Thomas Frank, most famously 12 years ago, in What's the Matter with Kansas, was trying to warn the Democratic Party that the rise of the new Democrats, so this is folks like the Clintons and Al Gore and such, where they ran against the working class and in many ways demonized the working class. They ran explicitly against the New Deal, said that we have to break from that kind of mindset, past all the, you know, key deregulation, even more desupervision, cut the federal agencies that were supposed to regulate banks and savings and loans, the FDIC by more than three quarters, the savings and loan industry regulators by more than half, helped produce this disaster for the working class and this economic crisis. So Frank saw them turning the their back, and Thomas Frank is a historian. He's got a doctorate in history, but also a very vivid writer. And he grew up in Kansas, and Kansas, as some people know, used to be a very progressive state. It, of course, was back in pre-Civil War, bloody Kansas, when it was a free state against slavery and such, and sent many soldiers to fight on behalf of the Union, has an extremely progressive constitution from, again, back in 1860-ish, but it is now one of the most conservative political places in the world. And this is Tom Frank is writing before Brownback comes to full power in Kansas. So Frank is saying, you know, you can't kick the working class, demonize them, and then expect them to come enthusiastically to the polls to vote for you. And Frank's second message was, and the policies you're adopting are bad policies. So they're not just bad politically, they're bad substantively for the nation. And he's come back to this recently, published a new book this year, Listen, Liberal, that brings home this theme. In between, he did things like The Wrecking Crew about how George Bush's folks were even worse. But the point is, both major parties have put up candidates over the last 35 years who have largely pushed in a neoliberal direction, and it ain't working well, and it's also, the Democrats, if they cared about their party, should try to save it from these folks. So that was the central theme of that column, the high price that we paid by not listening to Tom Frank.
So, but let's just explore, though, the premise of why Clinton moved the Democratic Party to the center. And you know, the assumption is in American politics is that in the primaries, the Republicans move to the right to satisfy their base, the Democrats move to the left to satisfy their base, and both parties move back to the center in the general election. And that the assumption's always been that essentially the average American voter is in the center. And the Democrats hold up the 1972 disaster of George McGovern as an example of, if you go too far to the left, you get wiped out. Is there any empirical evidence to say that a Bernie Sanders could, in fact, get elected president in the United States? Because that's the rationale that one hears from kind of Democratic strategists, is that simply that, you know, it's a suicide mission to go too far to the left.
Well, I mean, it is a suicide lesson strategy to go too far to either the left or the right, because, of course, if you go far enough to the left, you end up with Marxist-Stalinist, and if you go far enough to the right, you end up with Hitler. You know, clearly these are not good strategies, but the Clintons didn't move so much to the center as they moved really far to the right. So They consciously adopted Republican positions on a host of issues, from foreign invasions. They wanted a muscular, robust foreign policy. Be careful what you ask for. Where the United States would be, you know, quite willing to use its military might on other countries. They wanted to end welfare. They wanted to dramatically deregulate and desupervise the financial sector. They wanted an exceptionally pro-business spin on the party. I got out of the regulatory ranks that you talked about, my positions under the Clinton administration when, and I personally witnessed this, they directed us that we were to refer to the banks and to think of the banks as, and I quote, our customers. All right, so that's not a centrist position. That's a position that would have potentially embarrassed Margaret Thatcher if you had stated it that boldly. And by the way, to bring that up, Tony Blair and New Labor consciously modeled himself on the Clintons and the rise of the New Democrats. And as with the Clintons adopting so many of the Reaganite policies, New Labor under Tony Blair went after the unions as the villains, and which is kind of interesting for a party called the Labor Party, and consciously adopted a broad range of Thatcherite policies as their own. And in so doing, as did the New Democrats, set the stage for the financial crisis. And so it was, you know, not just Democrats and New Labor, but it was prominently both of these who led the disastrous race to the bottom between Wall Street and the City of London. And indeed, the dynamics we've talked about were even more extreme in the United Kingdom, which is why the City of London ended up the financial cesspool of the world.
But in the case of New Labour and Tony Blair, he got an extraordinary majority, and they have a different political system, obviously, and he was able to really change in the way that you described. In the case of Bill Clinton, he only, just like Barack Obama, he had 2 years where he had a democratically controlled House and Senate and didn't get a lot done. And in the case is also true with Obama. When he first came in, he had 2 years of democratic control of the House and Senate, and only got the stimulus package through, which was half of what they should have gotten. And then then the Republicans took over, and the same in 94, the Republicans took over under Newt Gingrich. How much does that have to do with what limiting a president's, I mean, even if he wasn't inclined to move to the right, did the circumstances of having to deal with the Republican Congress force him to negotiate with the right and move to the right?
No, he welcomed that opportunity. So two things. One is, you obviously are correct, we're talking about, one is a parliamentary system where almost by definition you have a working majority. And if you don't, your government falls. And our system that can have this split between the legislature or portions of the legislature and the control of the executive branch. So, yes, they're certainly different and the dynamics are different. But two things in terms of the strategy of Bill Clinton and Al Gore. First, you are not helpless as a president of the United States when the other party holds control of the House and the Senate, because the executive has enormous powers. And in particular, it has enormous powers over, of course, the administrative and regulatory ranks. And so Bill Clinton was able to, as I said, cut the FDIC staff by more than three quarters, to cut the Office of Thrift Supervision staff by more than a half. He was free to instruct us that we were to treat the banks as our customers. He was free to do as he did, transfer the prosecutors who were prosecuting financial elites over to Medicare fraud. So you have a very large scope of activity, and much of the damage that was done that led to the most recent crisis was done in those regulatory ranks. Now, Tony Blair did the same thing, by the way. In fact, I have a whole article about his infamous speech in 2005 in which he attacked the Financial Services Agency, the FSA, which was a farce. With what, as you know, in England was called light touch regulation. He attacked it as a regulatory ogre. That was vastly too fierce. So Blair did that as well. But the second thing is that Clinton found common cause with Newt Gingrich, of all people. They both really wanted to go after welfare. They both wanted to partially or fully privatize Social Security. Indeed, it was the extreme right of the Republican Party that blocked that quote-unquote grand bargain.
Well.
So... it was relevant politically. If he wanted to get legislation passed, it was going to have the support of Republicans. But Clinton found on welfare, he found on Social Security, he found on destroying the ability to regulate derivatives for the Commodities Future Modernization Act. He found with the Republicans in the destruction of Glass-Steagall, eager partners in these actions. Clinton was not forced to squash Brooks Lee Bourne in her effort to protect us from derivatives. That was not a Republican initiated. That was Democratic initiated. It was bipartisan,
sure,
but it was Democratic initiated, as was Glass-Steagall's destruction.
Right, and obviously he was doing the bidding of Treasury Secretary Rubin and...
More than that, the new Democrats at all times, once they really created a group, their primary funding of their policy apparatus, the DLC, was overwhelmingly from big finance. And they really viewed big finance as a wonderful partner. This was in part because, you know, the finance execs are not necessarily conservative on personal matters, you know, such as treatment of women, blacks, gays, and such. They may treat all of them badly in practice, but if you get them in a room, they'll give you a wonderful speech about the need for non-discrimination. So they were allies that you could show, you know, you could, it's like in a law firm, white-collar defendants look good. Mm-hmm. Blue-collar defendants don't look good in your waiting room.
Well, but let's go back to the question that I still have, and that is that we're talking about, you know, the Democrats selling out the working class. But the alternative has always been infinitely worse, which is the Republicans. And the question still remains, is there, we don't have anything to compare it against because we've never had a Bernie Sanders for president. And I still wonder whether that could happen, whether this country is so sufficiently sort of brainwashed by the Chamber of Commerce to make that impossible. Or do you think that there's, because we don't have any comparisons, do we? I mean, except maybe going back to Roosevelt, FDR's farewell address, where he talked about, what was it, the four freedoms?
Yes. So the FDR, most historians divide it, the New Deal into the first and the second New Deal, and say that the second New Deal was much more fundamental in its changes. And both Roosevelt and Truman thought of, we need to extend economic freedoms, that this has become essential to move the nation forward. And of course, eventually, and that was not, Eisenhower is not necessarily hostile to that general concept. It's only when you get into the Reagans and such, and the Goldwater, of course, in his running, that you get far more of this Ayn Randish stuff of the Republican Party being outright hostile to any concern for inequality. Plus, it figured it can pick up enough of the working class. After all, the New Democrats are gut-punching them every chance they get. So, you know, if we simply aren't nasty to them, we will be the beneficiaries of lots of these things. Now, Bernie Sanders had an extraordinary run. A few things would have had to break differently, but he gave a real true contest to Hillary Clinton, and he's older. He had never run for national office, didn't have the huge name recognition, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, I think other candidates can follow similar progressive policies and have a real chance in the future. But yeah, we all saw that the Democratic, you know, the DNC is definitely controlled by people who are not just hostile to Bernie Sanders. I mean, the head of the DNC is someone who's in is a major supporter of folks like payday lenders. Right, so this is the really sick old New Democrat stuff run deep, and we'll see whether that apparatus can actually be turned into a much more progressive organ. But you've seen Democrats winning on big issues of late, and big appointments, for example. Where Obama wanted to put more and more Wall Street people in, and those got blocked by progressives in the Senate. The big wins are occurring as much on the progressive side, indeed more than on any new Democrat side these days.
But just in closing, though, given that we're discussing on this 4th of July the idea of an economic revolution, economic independence day, in FDR's final farewell address before he died, he did talk about the need for an economic bill of rights, did he not?
He did, and that's precisely what we, in particular the University of Missouri-Kansas City Economics Department, that's what we do in significant part. I mean, we do other things, obviously, but this is what we talk about in trying to get people to understand how money really works, and we have a major policy objective that we, you know, my colleagues have been working on for decades, which is the job guarantee program, and that would really transform the economy of the United States in a way that would be exceptionally positive for the nation. And it would be a really good policy for Democrats if they were to adopt it.
Well, William K. Black, I thank you very much for joining us here today on Independence Day.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with William K. Black, who's a distinguished scholar in residence for financial regulation at the University of Minnesota, as well as a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He's the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s, and a white-collar criminologist and the founding member of Bank Whistleblowers United, and the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow. Bye for now.